Morning, everybody. We are now in chapter 2 of the second letter to Timothy. If you've got your Bibles open or switched on. Have you ever been in a situation where something has been dropped on you, so to speak, at very short notice? When you're called to step into the breach with very little warning, and you feel completely unprepared and inadequate to meet the bill. I've read stories, as I'm sure you must have, of the opera singer who gets laryngitis and has had to pull out of the opening night of some gala performance, and some unknown, inexperienced understudy has to step in at the last moment. I guess the nearest that I've had to that was probably a couple of occasions in the last 30 years or so, when a fellow pastor has been taken ill, and I've been called on to preach the message at the 11th hour. Usually, in such circumstances, the church is only too happy if you do what I call a Blue Peter sermon. Here is one I prepared earlier. It's a lot more difficult if you have to speak unprepared about a particular passage where you've not got an old sermon as a backup. Now, this is the sort of challenge that is suddenly facing Timothy. And as we saw last week, this letter to Timothy, that's the second one that Paul wrote, was written in circumstances where Paul was now facing imminent death for his Christian witness. And he's wanting to equip and to encourage Tim as best he can to carry on the kind of leadership role which Paul himself had exercised for so many years in the Christian church. And on the face of it, and Tim being a kind of a young, timid, inexperienced person, he seems to be a most unlikely person for the challenge. The danger is that in the wake of Paul's untimely demise, Tim might be tempted to withdraw from the battle. Or he might just sit dithering on the brink, wondering whether he can cope. Perhaps just passively waiting until he feels strong enough to act. Whereas Paul urgently wants Timothy to be strong, to take up the mantle, and to do it quickly. He wants to launch him out onto the waters with faith to discover for himself that Christ not only keeps him afloat, but actually empowers him for the task. And the urgency, as I said, is because Paul can see the final curtain coming in his own life. And before long, Timothy will no longer have Paul's fatherly advice and care and wisdom. But he'll be on his own. And so Paul begins this second chapter, the letter, with this exhortation: be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. Now, folks, this isn't just rhetoric here, or some kind of heroic stoicism that Paul is advocating. It's not be strong in the sense of the British stiff upper lip, the public kind of public school tradition. It is specifically be strong in the grace that is, in Christ Jesus. In other words, the activity demanded is more than matched by the grace provided. To be apprehensive, to be reticent, is no excuse, because God delights in such circumstances to show his strength. Now, this grace that Paul's referring to, it's not some kind of commodity that you can order out of the heavenly larder or pick from the divine supermarket. Grace is part and parcel of God's self-giving relationship with us. And so Tim is being called to look to Christ as his inspiration and enabler. You will find the strength of Christ flowing into him and through him as he steps out in faith. But he has to step out. And Paul's purpose is to give Timothy a gentle push in case he was hesitant to do that. Now, in particular, what Tim needs to be strong about is not the reception of the gospel message, but its transmission. It's absolutely vital that the gospel must be passed on, a bit like a baton in a relay race. Passed safely into the hands of those who will grasp it firmly, proclaim it boldly, and suffer for it bravely. Now, the people that Paul wants Timothy to be strong in appointing, he says, are people who will be reliable. This is in verse 2. People who will be reliable and able to teach others. And by reliable, Paul doesn't just mean in the sense of they're not flip-flopping from one spiritual fad to another, that they they don't turn up on time, they let people down. He means these people must be faithful to the gospel. They mustn't be theological butterflies who change the current whatever the current flavor of to what the, they must not change to what the current flavor of the month is. And sadly, I think that's all too common. You get that so frequently in the church today. Churches seeking all kinds of gimmicks, what they hope to be magic bullets that will bring revival, get people in, make the church trendy, and so on. And you see, it's so easy to get one's priorities wrong in church ministry, to lose your way. Those of us who are trained as pastors, we start off so keen and enthusiastic. We're going to convert the world. But then over the years, we can easily get bogged down with the administration, the fundraising, tending to people's pastoral needs, putting a new roof on the church, all those sorts of things. And sometimes pastors become too concerned with their career path. We start to network and to get on committees to be noticed. Or we pursue some pet scheme. And I have seen way too many ministers become politicians or social workers with dog collars. And it is all too easy in this whirl of activity to forget the central task of ministry, which is to proclaim Jesus Christ and bring others to him. You know, I've heard so many sermons where Jesus simply isn't mentioned. God might come up quite a lot, but not necessarily the God as we see him in reflection from Christ. Is that because we might offend people? Because once we are ashamed of Jesus, we have lost our way. And the church in the West, I think, largely has lost its way. And much of the church, I think, has got a full-blown identity crisis. A kind of spiritual schizophrenia, if you like. There was a bumper sticker on a car I once saw years ago, which I think illustrated this very well. It was a really beat-up old VW Beetle. And it had two bumper stickers. And the one of them said, "Honk if you love Jesus." And the other one, adjacent to it, said, "If you touch a my car, I break a your face." And so many churches and individual Christians today are suffering from that kind of spiritual schizophrenia. Their beliefs and their behavior are at odds with the Christian gospel they represent. They demonstrate utter confusion. What we Christians believe is important, and it's vital that we don't unconsciously or deliberately tone down our beliefs, either to make them more acceptable or more palatable to society. And I'm afraid that's exactly what the church has done in Britain during these past few decades. Miracles, resurrection, virgin birth, too hard, dump them. The Bible against sex outside of marriage, forget it. Our culture has moved on. The uniqueness of Jesus, too embarrassing and intolerant in our multi-faith society today. Ignore those parts of the Bible. No. These verses speak of sound teaching and the deposit of teaching which has to be guarded. Timothy must be true to the core teaching, not twist it or downplay it to make himself popular or trendy. Because you cannot have Jesus as Lord without obeying his words. You cannot believe in Jesus and deny his resurrection. You cannot believe in Jesus and adopt the world's ethics and morals. And many churches, many individual Christians have ignored that, sadly, to their cost. But the wonderful thing is that even though many churches have gone under, many Christians have backslidden, the gospel has never gone under. Paul says back in chapter 1, which we looked at last week, if you remember, in verse 12 of chapter 1, he says he's quite sure that God is able to keep that gospel intact until the day when Jesus comes back. And this is why Paul says, choose reliable people rather than successful people. Okay? People who will reliably stick with the gospel message, even when it's not popular or politically correct. Reliable in the sense of being utterly faithful to the gospel, not being swayed or deviated to go off at a tangent. If you have a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 2, Paul there says, "Now it's required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful." Okay? And you remember in the Gospels, in one of the parables Jesus told about the faithful steward, he said at the end, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Not successful necessarily. And you know, you can spend years exercising Christian ministry without always seeing loads of success. Success is what the world goes after. But God is looking for those who are faithful and who are reliable in the way in which they handle the gospel. And the other thing that Paul says is that they have to be qualified to teach others. If someone's not able to teach, they can leave people more confused than when they started. The two things are both needed in establishing the gospel for the next generation. It's no good being reliable and faithful if you can't teach others. That won't keep a church going against persecution. It's no use being able to teach but not being reliable or dependent or dependable theologically, not standing like a rock for the gospel. That, I think, is the true apostolic succession. Passing on faithfully the apostolic message and teaching it to others. And that principle, I have to say, it's applicable not just to pastors or ministers. It's equally true for those leading children's groups or home groups or Bible studies or discipling those on a one-to-one basis. But there's a cost involved. And here's where Paul comes back to the theme of suffering, which we mentioned last week in chapter 1. And the truth is, if you're going to live for the gospel, you're going to have to accept there's going to be suffering involved. There'll be a sacrifice. Once you start living the Christ life, the powers of the world, the flesh, and the devil are suddenly ranged against you. And so Paul is forever talking about suffering. And he reminds us that a suffering-free life is not the privilege of every Christian. It's going to be a struggle, at least at times. It was for Paul. It will be for us. And then he has these three metaphors in this chapter: a soldier, an athlete, and a farmer. Now, what do these three things have in common? I wonder if you can determine. What's Paul saying? Because at first sight, there may not seem to be any obvious connection. Someone's fighting a war, someone's ploughing a field, someone's training for the Olympics. Well, I think the point that Paul is making is that each of those things, in order to get the best, involves a level of hard work. You will need the dedication of a soldier, the discipline of an athlete, and the diligence of a farmer. Three little word pictures, but they're designed to convey that living for Christ is costly. It's painstaking sometimes. And if you've ever had connections to the farming community, The thing that I think that will have struck you is that being a farmer, whether with livestock or with growing crops, it's a career that is unbelievably hard work. Those guys are usually up before light, milking the cows, before they even get back to have their own breakfast. It's hard work. Being a soldier demands discipline and training. Running through assault courses with packs on your back is exhausting, I can tell you. Likewise with being an athlete. I mean, everybody just thinks of Usain Bolt larking around at the beginning of the 100 metres. But you just read about his training regime. It is unbelievable, the discipline of it. A while ago, the famous athlete, I think he's decathlon, Daley Thompson, he was interviewed a while ago, and he said, everyone wants to stand on the podium collecting the gold medal, but no one wants to run along the banks of the Thames at 6 o'clock when it's snowing in January. And I thought that was a really good insight about the discipline you need if you're going to be a top athlete. But part of that discipline is sticking to the rules. And that's what Paul highlights at the end of verse 5, if you notice. I think it's easy to see his point these days. But as we live in an era where doping in sport is a regular occurrence. And Paul says the athlete doesn't receive the victor's crown unless he competes according to the rules. And some of you might well remember the short-lived victory of Ben Johnson in the 1988 Olympics. For a time it appeared he'd just outstripped all the competitors on the field, and he just romped home to victory. But soon afterwards he was stripped of his gold medal. Why? Because he hadn't competed according to the rules. The rules of entry and competing are external, but they complement the internal discipline that marks out an athlete in their training and exercise program. Now, some of us will reap wonderful blessings from God if we've put the daily dogged discipleship work in. Day by day, reading our Bibles when we don't feel like it. By sharing our faith when we are feeling pretty wretched ourselves. By coming to church even when the last thing we want is to be with those annoying Christians. But over the years you build up a bank of spiritual maturity. And then when the times of trouble come, you've got resources to draw on. But God will be faithful to you in the dark if you remember how you walked with him in the light. It is hard work, this thing. And it is all about commitment. I think one of the characteristics of our postmodern society has been to trivialise commitment. And it's come to mean for many people that commitment is just what I feel like at the moment. And that is why church hopping is so much more popular now than it was years ago. A, because transport is much more readily available. We live in a mobile age. But the other thing is that if the worship of your church is not as inspiring as you would like it to be, or if the preaching is not the most stimulating, or the church down the road is the popular place with your friends, it's the spiritual flavor of the month, then it is very easy just to be up and off. Now, sometimes one has to leave churches, and can be good reasons for that. But often we are very superficial and impetuous and impatient. And it's a sad sign of our immaturity. And so we need to commit to the hard work of following Jesus in athlete terms, in farmer terms, and in soldier terms. The foundation of our discipleship doesn't rest on our feelings, but we follow God because He is faithful to us and because it's the right thing to do. You know, when I went to theological seminary, as we called it, nobody warned me that being faithful to Jesus, as revealed in the Bible, would be hard work demanding integrity, backbone, and stickability. You know, I naively thought that ministering and working amongst Christians would be the promised land. Don't you believe it? Present company accepted. But when you've got to hang on to your integrity and have the courage of your convictions, you find it brings opposition and rejection. People will disappoint you and misunderstand you. And that is why Paul wants to stiffen Timothy's resolve to cope with all of that. And so Paul goes on to say to Timothy in verse 8, remember Jesus Christ, raised from the dead, descended from David. Now, you might well think, well, how can Tim, as a committed Christian, forget Jesus? How can you forget Jesus? How can I forget Jesus? I tell you, human nature is so fickle. If you want to see whether you remember Jesus Christ or not, just face a crisis in your life. A life-changing situation where you've got to make a decision or something like that. A problem. A dilemma you don't know quite what to do about. And what you do instinctively will give you a clue. Maybe you just think about the ramifications, the implications, the consequences of course A or course B, whatever. But is that the point where you actually consider Jesus and what his purposes are for you? What does he want? What is his will here? It goes from a domestic dilemma to business decisions to every choice you make in life concerning your future. But I think Paul is also saying to Timothy, remember Jesus Christ for another reason. The context is still the soldier, the athlete, the farmer. Endurance. You see, Jesus is the suffering servant who himself exemplified in his own life the dedication, the diligence, the discipline that we are called to have. Paul mentions here he is descended from David. What he's doing is reminding us, highlighting Jesus' humanity. But he has been raised from the dead, which highlights his divinity. And so we are to remember Jesus Christ, who in the words of Hebrews chapter 12, endured the cross. And then it goes on to say, consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And then finally in this little section, in verses 11 to 13, Paul quotes what's thought to be a verse from an old first century hymn, but it expresses a general promise which I think can be applied to every one of you. Do you get laughed at because you're a Christian? Do your neighbours think that you are strange? Do you feel embarrassed for the Lord's sake? Then listen to these words. If you die with him, you will live with him. You will never have God in your debt. In this life, you might lose houses and lands and brothers and sisters and so on, but God always repays a thousandfold. He rewards a dedicated soldier, a disciplined athlete, a diligent farmer. If you endure with him, you will reign with him. You might be treated with humiliation and scorn by the world. You may be humbled. You may lose your dignity because you're a Christian. But one day you will reign. Look forward to that. You don't mind being in the dust here if you're going to reign there. But here is the other side of the promise. Quoting from the Gospels, Paul says this, and he's echoing what Jesus said. If you're ashamed of me, I will be ashamed of you when I come. Deny me, and I will deny you before my Father. That is the seriousness of it. God is faithful to his promises, but he's also faithful to his warnings. And when it says faithless in verse 13, it is present continuous tense, meaning to go on being faithless. Now, sometimes, yes, we do deny him, don't we? In moments of weakness, like Simon Peter did. You remember he denied Jesus? But he repented and Christ restored him. Why? Because God knows the intentions of our hearts. And we can be absolutely sure that if we come to God in faith, he will instantly cancel all our past rejections or denials of him. But what's vital is to persevere in building up our spiritual bank accounts now, so that we have the necessary resources when the tough times come and the temptation to disown him is that much stronger. So, how do you persevere in these circumstances? Let me come back to verse 8. Remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. That's my final thought I want to leave with you this morning. If you live for the gospel, you won't find it easy. But the way you will endure is by remembering Jesus Christ, raised from the dead. When all else fails, remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. When the world turns against you, remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. When society becomes confused and lost, remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. And when even the church refuses to hear or to follow the gospel, then especially remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. If we don't hold to that, we have absolutely nothing to tell this needy world except some platitudes and a bit of moralizing. Whatever else you think, whatever else you say, whatever else you do, keep Jesus Christ in the center. Believe in him, honor him, obey him, cherish him. That's where our focus has to be. When you feel alone and abandoned, remember Jesus Christ. When you feel frightened and lost, remember Jesus Christ. When your heart is aching, remember Jesus Christ. When you wonder what on earth is going on, remember Jesus Christ, because you can be sure he will remember you everlastingly. Let's just bow our heads in prayer for a moment. You might just have a moment of quiet. In the silence, you might just want to respond to anything God may have said to you through this passage this morning.